Hi, I'm Kathy Forsty, music director at KC Cafe Radio. We're very happy to have a legendary songwriter, Art Podell, as a KC Cafe Radio artist. We recently added his album, From the Village to the Canyon, A Songwriter's Journey, to our playlist. This album is an artistic chronicle of Art's personal history in the folk music scene, from Greenwich Village to his journey west in the canyons of California. Art has an amazing repertoire of musicians he has worked with over the years, and has helped bring one of the most classic songs of all time to the world. Thanks so much, Art, for taking the time to talk with me today here on KC Cafe Radio.
Well, thank you for even considering to talk to me.
Well, it's a great pleasure. One of the things I wanted to... You have such a rich history in music, especially in the folk music scene. And you're pretty much there from the beginning, especially in Greenwich Village. You started singing in Greenwich Village, what year, 1955? Is that right?
Well, I started hanging around the village as a high school kid. I grew up in Brooklyn. And so I would sneak up to the village and listen to it. Well, and you know, you can't really say I was there at the beginning, because the beginning keeps going back. Every time you find somebody who was at the beginning, there was somebody he learned from who was at the other beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think I was kind of at the beginning of when folk music became popular. In 1958 was the Kingston Trio. That electrified everybody. But I was down in Greenwich Village in the early 50s as a high school kid, just kind of hanging around, listening to whatever I could listen to, sneaking out and coming home late to do that, because most of the folk music in the village in those days was not in the big coffee houses and the clubs like it was later. It was down in basements and in theaters that had let out in Greenwich Village, and they had midnight concerts. I remember it was the first place I saw people like Pete Seeger, Josh White, Will Gear, Will Holt. Some of these names are probably lost on a younger audience, but these were some of the underpinnings of the early folk era. But they would have midnight concerts. The shows would let out at midnight in Greenwich Village. They had these little theaters there. They did Eugene O'Neill plays and, you know, all kinds of real artistic stuff. They would do, and then when the show ended, they'd clean out the theater, and then all the little folkies would slip in at midnight and you'd hear these wonderful concerts.
Yeah. So were you?
I find it difficult to stay up beyond midnight these days.
Well, you did all yours back when you were younger. Were you playing as well, or were you just like hanging out and listening, or?
Oh no, I was taking guitar lessons from a guitar teacher and playing 3 and 4 chords, and I bought all the Burl Ives records and I learned how to sing Jimmy Crack Corn, and Nicodemus the Slave, and all of the Burl Ives songs, and then onto the Pete Seeger songs, and I was in a learning phase back then I was just a young high school kid.
Yeah.
At that time, you know, and it wasn't until, you know, 1959-60 that I actually moved to the village.
Uh-huh. And you were performing then is when you moved there?
Yeah. Well, what happened with me in the village was I had become friendly with some people who became lifelong friends, people like Dick Rasmini, who's the name is not a familiar name, but I don't think the 12-string guitar or guitar playing by people like Dave Van Ronk or Leo Kottke would be what it is today if not for guys like Rasmini, who really dug all that stuff out of the Deep South and put a three-finger picking style on the guitar, 12-string and 6-string, and made it what it is today. But I had lots of friends who kind of coached me and stuff, and I was, you know, by no means a real prodigy. I was just another kid, you know, playing folk songs and singing folk songs. That, you know, all the fervor and everything, was anytime somebody would dig up a song from the Appalachian Mountains, we were there. And on Sundays at Washington Square, there would be a gathering of people. Everybody would gather in their own groups. And since there was no money in folk music, I mean, nobody had ever really proven that you could make a lot of money in it. People were trading songs freely. There was none of this business of this is my song and this is your song. Very few people were writing their own material.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a wonderful era of exploration where you'd... Where you'd just wander into Washington Square, and there'd be a little group singing, and they'd be singing some songs you'd never heard before in your life, and you'd grab it and you'd learn it, and there'd be one group standing in a corner singing "Oh, Sinner Man" for 2 hours straight, you know, verse after verse after verse, and repeating it, and more kids would jump in on the thing, and we'd almost be like a high school class singing one song, then we'd jump to another one that we had just learned. It wasn't really productive for me, in other than just being a wonderful learning ground and a wonderful place to enjoy myself and meet wonderful people.
It
happened when an old partner of mine that I used to do, believe it or not, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis stand-up comedy shows with in high school, Paul Potash, got out of the Army, and we started singing folk songs. And between the two of us, since Paul had no folk music background, his background was theater and Broadway and that kind of stuff. Paul, he knew how to tap dance. It was just amazing to me. I made him promise if we went to the village, he wouldn't tap dance. Because we would have been excommunicated from the community. But Paul and I put together some vocal arrangements, and that was so distinctly unique, it instantly made us a phenomenon in the village that everybody wanted to come see, and something that totally puzzled the record companies. They almost didn't want anything to do with us until some young producer from Columbia Records, who was a prodigy of Mitch Miller, a guy named Tony Piano, a wonderful guy, came and said, "I want to record you guys." And so Brosmini and myself and Paul went into the studio at Columbia, and we made our first album. And people, I mean, to this day, look at us and say, "Boy, you guys were doing stuff that nobody even knew could be done with music."
Yeah.
And that was really the beginning of it. But that was right around the time when music was just starting to bubble up. As I said before, the Kingston Trio had established the fact in 1958 that you could have a national hit with folk music.
Yeah.
When they recorded Tom Dooley, that exploded, and that's when everybody started sniffing around the village to see who was there, that who was available, and the ones who ultimately won the game, obviously, if you look at history, were the people that were writing their own material.
Right.
Because all of that old Appalachian material was already spoken for. Publishing, who knew about pop? I didn't know anything about music publishing.
Yeah.
I thought, you publish books. I didn't know you published music. But the people that were writing songs garnered the interest of people like Albert Grossman, the managers, the record companies.
Right.
And that's when folk music really became an industry.
Yeah.
Up until then, it had been strictly an academic endeavor and a political endeavor on the part of the people that came in the 40s and very early 50s, the Pete Seegers, the Almanac Singers. I may be speaking some history that's a little obscure, but you asked the question, and the answer's been waiting for somebody to ask for a while, so
yeah.
I figured that you're it.
Yeah. So, I mean, when would you... I don't know. This is really a tough question, I guess. And I guess it's something that's... I guess folk music has existed forever, really.
Of course.
And I guess... why do you think that Greenwich Village was the place where this all kind of culminated and just really took off? Why do you think it was there rather than, like, Boston or California or...
Well, I think to be true to it, in thinking back, I think that it was happening everywhere. I think it was a national phenomenon because it's Paul and I, since we're on Columbia Records, we were invited to sing elsewhere, and we went other places. In the major cities, Boston, Chicago, it the same thing was happening. It's just that Greenwich Village drew so much popularity and attention from people that no matter where they were from, they would at least visit Greenwich Village once.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of a like home base, but you can't play baseball with just home base. There was a small folk community in Boston, definitely. Chicago, Old Town School of Folk Music, Frank Hamilton and Bob Gibson and Bob Camp. These were guys that were slugging it out with folk music right along the time that I was there in Greenwich Village, and they were singing at the Gate of Horn, so there was a vibrant folk music community in Chicago.
Yeah.
Denver was another hotbed. of music. San Francisco, definitely. It's just that somehow or other, you know, I don't know, history and society seem to isolate one place, and we tend to, you know, subrogate the rest of them to somewhere in the shadows. But it was happening everywhere. We would have people, you know, once we started spreading out, we would go to, Paul and I would go to Denver, and heck, we met Judy Collins, Tommy and Dickie Smothers, David Crosby. He was 16, just in high school, hanging out playing folk songs in Denver. Len Chandler, Don Crawford, Judy Roderick. The list goes on. Denver had its own little folk community.
Yeah.
And when we got to Los Angeles, it was like a mini Greenwich Village. But somehow or other, you know, the attention, the historians draw their attention to one place and make that the focal point.
Right.
New York has always enjoyed that spotlight. When anything happens, if it happens in New York too, everybody seems to look that way and ignore the rest, but it's not true.
Right. It doesn't really happen unless it happened in New York first. like with fashion and music and movies and all that kind of stuff. So.
Right. In fact, I was just reading an article a friend from New York sent me about how great it is to come to Los Angeles from New York, especially after a winter of bleak weather. But that's another story.
Right.
No, there's always been that tension between New York and L.A., and there's always been that tension between L.A. and San Francisco. Hmm. You know, if you're a Los Angeles music act, you try to get booked in San Francisco. You got to go through a little more of a rigorous test before you're accepted.
Really? Wow. So I want to talk about Art and Paul, your partner, Paul Potash. How did the two of you come to collaborate and start working together?
Well, what happened was I was just kind of winding down college, and Paul showed up on my doorstep. I was living in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and driving down to the village, believe it or not, on a motor scooter every day. Fort Lee, New Jersey is right across the George Washington Bridge. It's where that whole brouhaha happened last year with some politics that happened there.
Yeah.
But with the governor of New Jersey. But I used to live right across the bridge. It was convenient and cheap, and finishing up my time at Columbia. And I was on my motor scooter heading down to Greenwich Village all the time. And Potash had been in the Army. I hadn't talked to him since very early high school, when we were a comedy team and singing some songs for my mother's organizations.
So were you like the Smothers Brothers kind of thing, or...?
No, we were Martin and Lewis. We did stand-up slapstick. Paul has got to be one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. Paul Potash is just an amazing comedian. People to this day talk about watching Paul on stage. I mean, he was a physical comedian. He could do things with his body and his face that I don't know anybody could do, and his timing was impeccable. Just one of those brilliant natural comedians with a voice that I would probably easily sacrifice almost anything for. Paul had just an incredibly beautiful baritone voice, and so when he tried his hand at when he hooked up with me, he got out of the Army is what happened, and didn't really know what he wanted to do. And he knocked on my door in Patterson, New Jersey, in Fort Lee, New Jersey. His family lived in Patterson, which was not too far. And he knocked on my door, and there he was. And I said, "Hey, you want to do something together?" We started practicing folk songs, and we realized that we had something between us that we had never heard before.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started working on arrangements, and then we decided, we said, "Well, heck, this is stupid for us to be doing this up here." So what we did was we got ourselves a little apartment down on the Lower East Side, which is now the East Village or Soho. Very she. Back then, it was just on the border of three war zones. And it was on the 2nd Avenue and 5th Street. We had a little apartment. And we sat there for a week, a month. Neither of us had a nickel to our name. And we rehearsed songs. We picked our favorite folk songs.
Mm-hmm.
And did arrangements of them. And then I showed them to Dick Rosmini, and Dick said, "You guys are incredible." He said, "I've never heard anything like this." And so he grabbed his grabbed his guitar and we started playing around the clubs, and that's really where the whole career thing opened up. That's where I met Peter. We were singing in the same clubs as Peter Yarrow, mm-hmm. and Noel Stuckey, Paul, you know, Peter and Paul, and I knew just about everybody in the village. And Peter had just come down from Cornell. I had been doing a little gig with an Israeli folk song group. Hmm. And when Peter got to town, he said, you know, are there any gigs around? I said, well, I just signed this contract with Columbia Records with Art and Paul, and I need, and this folk song group that I was singing with needs somebody, but they make money. They go around to Jewish congregations and sing the folk songs, and the lead person in this little group that I was with is a dancer, and she does, you know, Israeli dances. But they pay, you know, $50 a show. And so Peter said, I'm in for that. He said, but I can't speak Hebrew. So I had to teach Peter all of these Hebrew songs that I knew, because I had a religious school background in Brooklyn where I grew up, and I had learned how to speak Hebrew and how to sing all these songs. So I taught them all rote to him, and he got a job, and he stayed with them for quite a while, and that was how he was supporting himself until Albert Grossman came along and tapped him on the shoulder and said, I want you to be part of a group I'm building.
Yeah. So. And that was Peter, Paul, and Mary?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. What year was that?
I think that was probably 1960.
Wow. Very cool.
About around 1960.
So tell me how you guys became one of the first people to record Puff the Magic Dragon.
Oh, that's interesting. What happened was we had, you know, there was a life around the village. The Cafe Wa was kind of the center for us. There were other clubs in the village that were the center for other people. The Wa was one place. That was where I met Peter, and it's where Paul performed every night. He was a stand-up comic. Mr. Stuckey is a brilliant stand-up comic, and also was singing folk songs. Beautiful baritone voice, wonderful stage presence. Peter, to me, was the quintessential folk singer. Mm. If I had ever had any thoughts of becoming the next Pete Seeger, which I secretly harbored, they all were dashed when I heard Yarrow sing, because he just has a magical way of filling every song with himself and just making you believe what he's singing. And like Pete did, I mean that was the crucible where it all happened, and I was hanging around there. And then what happened was Paul and I were on Columbia Records. Albert Grossman, who had a hand in the Newport Folk Music Festival with George Ween, he was one of the creators of it, was looking for, he thought in his ultimate business wisdom that if he could find a group of two guys and one girl that could sing folk songs, that there was a market for it. And so he constructed Peter, Paul, and Mary. He got Peter at the Cafe Wa. He got Paul at the Cafe Wa. Mary, I'm not sure, but I remember one evening sitting at Minetta's Tavern with Peter, just sitting, which was right across the street from the Cafe Wa. Peter asked me, he said, we need a girl for this group. And I had remembered seeing this gal, Mary Travers, singing with a group called the Song Swappers or the Tune Tellers. It was just a put-together group of current older generation folk singers. She was this lovely little blonde gal that stood in the middle. And the Tune Tellers were Alan Arkin, who used to be a folk singer. You know, some of them. Yeah, he was a folk singer. He belonged to a group called... He belonged to the Terriers. I used to watch him at the Midnight concerts because Arkin's a little bit older than me. Mm-hmm. Thank God somebody is. and I remember Peter asking me, you know, do I know any girls? And I said, you may want to look up this girl, Mary Travers, because she doesn't have any vibrato and she's perfect for harmony and she's beautiful. So he wrote her name down on a piece of paper. And he said, okay, I'll ask around about her. I said, I think she lives here on the 7th floor in Minetta's. But that was the last time I had talked to him about it. Next time I heard was Mary as part of the group. And I have no idea if that conversation even stuck with Peter, but I feel like I'm a little part of that. Anyway, Paul and I were on Columbia Records, and so Peter knocked on our door one day, and he said, "Hey, listen, I've got this song. This is on the Lower East Side." He said, "I've got this song that Albert," this is probably 1960, early 61. He said, "I've got this song that I wrote up at, you know, with a friend in Cornell, at Cornell, and Albert doesn't want it on our first album. We're rehearsing for our first album now. He thinks it's a little
too controversial." That's hard to believe.
He said, "It's a little too controversial." I said, "Well, what's controversial about it?" He says, "I don't know." He said, "It's a children's song, but Albert thinks that people are going to take it the wrong way, and he doesn't, you know, he wants us to be, you know, kind of real clean to go out, you know, have our first, you know, record to be something, you know, really without any controversy on it." So, because obviously everybody thought it was about pot and marijuana, and she sang it to us, and we loved it. So we started singing it in the village, and then we started, since we were on Columbia Records, we had some tours lined up. We went out to Boulder, Colorado, to play at this one place called Mike's Pub down in Boulder, and we were so well received there that people from Boulder, from all the whole Denver area, used to come and see Art and Paul and Mike's Pub. And of course, one of the songs we sang was Puff the Magic Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually what happened was is that the University of Colorado, whoever plans their concerts there for the student concerts, called and said, "We'd like you to do a concert at the university." Well, this was a big deal for us. So we did that. And of course, we sang Puff the Magic Dragon. And it was, you know, tumultuously received. And I even mentioned that it was written by a friend of ours in New York. And when I said the words Peter, Paul, and Mary, everybody cracked up in the audience because they had never heard that name before. And the only association they had with Peter, Paul, and Mary was, you know what? And, you know, it was a religious association.
Yeah.
And so we sang it. And oddly enough, we didn't even know this until maybe 15 years later. Somebody had slipped the microphone in and had recorded it.
Hmm.
And just out of the blue, it showed up on a bootleg album called Hoot Manny. I don't know what it was called. I don't even know the name of it. It showed up on this Hoot Manny album years and years later.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Oh my God! I can't wait." I was hiding. I figured any minute somebody was going to knock on the door with a lawsuit, you know, for us pilfering the song. They're not doing. But oddly enough, whether it was Peter or Paul or whatever, the fates have always been very kind to us, and nobody's ever said anything. Everybody's kind of giggled and chuckled at it. But there it is. It's Puff the Magic Dragon. And I introduced it and had the audience sing it with us. We presented it as a children's song,
mm-hmm.
and presented it our way, not anybody else's.
Yeah.
But that was the story of Puff the Magic Dragon.
Yeah.
And then I remember when we got to L.A., we were known for Puff the Magic Dragon. Everybody requested it. If you were to go to Bob Stain, who runs the coffee gallery here in Los Angeles to this day, who used to run the Ice House, which was a big folk music center,
mm-hmm.
he would tell you, he said, if you hear, tell him Art and Paul, the first thing that pops into his mind is Puff the Magic Dragon. He said, that was our song.
Yeah.
And if you ask, well, Doug Weston's not around anymore at the Troubadour, people would come in to hear Puff the Magic Dragon. And just to put a capper on the story, I remember the night, and this is vivid in my memory, I was walking down the stairs from the dressing room. Dressing room was, Doug couldn't pay us, so we were sleeping up there. And as I walked up towards the stage, there's a black payphone. If anybody out there knows what a payphone is, it was a black payphone next to the door to the alley. Just as you walk in on the stage, and Dickie Davis, who's the doorman and a friend to this day, hands me the phone and says, "Artie, you got a phone call." I was just about to go on stage, and it was Peter. And Peter said, "Hey, Artie, listen, I hope you guys don't mind, but Albert decided that Puff the Magic Dragon will work on our first album."
Yeah.
And I should have said, "Yeah, Peter, thanks a lot," after we've promoted it all over the country.
Yeah,
for
no
you.
No kidding. You made it a hit for them.
I don't think so.
Probably. I mean,
yeah, we made it an underground hit, but those things don't translate them, by definition to major hits.
Yeah.
what happened is he said Albert really thinks that it really does belong on our first on this next album. I don't even remember if it was on their first album or not. But he said, but Albert decided that we are going to record it, so you can't record it until after we do. And I remember saying to him, well, Peter, I'll tell you what, it's real easy. If it's a hit for you, great. If it's not, then we'll record it. He said, fine, no problem. And that, and that was it. I went on stage, and of course we performed it, but we never recorded it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So you do have a compilation CD with Paul. That's available on your website.
Yeah, Columbia Records has lost the masters. I don't know. We've tried to find them, but I have a really nice set on my website of both Art and Paul albums. If anybody wants to hear some real unique music and real interesting stuff, just drop me a line on the website. There's a little link there, and the Puff the Magic Dragon is on that CD. It's also, if you do a YouTube search, if you just want to listen, you don't want to have to go through the trouble of.
Well, I think people should go buy that compilation because it's got some amazing songs on there. I was looking at the track listing, and it's got some just wonderful folk history right there.
Well, we could do this whole interview on Art and Paul. I'll tell you, to this day, with everything I've done in my musical career, when I see people I haven't seen in 20, 30, 40 years, and it happens almost all the time when I wander in and out of the music stores in L.A., like McKay's, people look at me and they go, Art, what the hell? Art and Paul. Yeah. That's what they remember me from.
Yeah.
Because we were so unique. I mean, Tim Hauser from Manhattan Transfer passed away last year, and Tim and I met for the first time face to face about 6 months before he passed away at an event. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh my God, Art and Paul, do you guys know how much you influenced what I've done with music?" He said, "When I first saw you guys in the Village, I was a kid." He said, "I realized when I listened to you that what you did with music is you could take almost any song and change it and move it and do things with it that people didn't expect."
Mm.
And that was one of the most flattering things I've ever heard. I'm so sorry that I had to wait until I was in my later years to hear that compliment.
Mm.
And it just absolutely amazed me. When we first moved into the Troubadour, some young kid approached Art and Paul and said, "Hey, you guys are doing things I've never heard before. Can I play bass behind you?" And I said, "Well, sure." And he played bass behind us. It was Charlie Hayden.
Oh, my gosh.
And Charlie played with us for 14 weeks. And he passed away a year or two ago.
Yeah.
But when I ran into Charlie in the 70s again, he said, "You guys," he said, "to this day," he said, "you guys, I don't know why you didn't continue. You guys would have been..." He said, I still haven't heard anything like what you guys were doing."
Yeah.
Our problem was we were doing traditional material in a very unusual way. And when I saw the movie Inside Llewellyn Davis, it all came into focus when Llewellyn Davis went to Chicago and sat down in front of the guy who owned the Gate of Horn, the guy, and played songs for him.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who was supposedly Albert Grossman looked at him and said, "I don't see any money here." Remember that part of the movie?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Well, it suddenly came into focus. Of course there was no money in Art and Paul. We were singing traditional folk songs done in a very unique way. There were no publishing royalties, no writer's royalties to play with. It wasn't until people like Tom Paxton, who wrote his own folk songs, and Bob Dylan came along, that the Hawks swooped in, because
right.
that's where the money was, publishing.
Right, and they take all the money, and the songwriter gets hardly anything. So
well, some of them were real smart. Some
yeah.
of them really were. They like in any business, they're the people that make the right decisions early on, and the ones that don't. Our problem was there were no decisions to be made. We didn't have any original material. I didn't start writing until recently.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a little bit, but I've always written, and I was lucky enough to write a lot of stuff that the Smothers Brothers recorded, and I've had enough people record my music, which is good, but I wasn't a dedicated, focused, songwriter who was out there pitching songs early on.
Right. So the songs on From the Village to the Canyon, are those newer songs, or are those songs that have been in your repertoire for a while?
What? It's a mixture. Most of the songs from the Village from the Canyon are recent songs that I've written, because when I came back to music, I left the music business after a while. And like so many people out there, there's a whole generation of people who went on with their lives to do other things and never quite put the guitar all the way in the back of the closet. And we just kind of kept it kind of handy and would pull it out from time to time. But yeah, most of the stuff on that album is stuff that was written very recently, within the last 5 years. There's one song there that I did that was recorded by the New Christy Minstrels and recorded by several other people. You've Heard My Voice and You Know My Name. Mm-hmm. That's an older song. That was one of the most favorite songs that we did with the New Christy Minstrels. I just did a revision of it. And did it on the CD, but everything on that CD is new, and there's only one song on it that I did not write, but I love it, and it's one of my performance gems, if I could pat myself on the back, because I just have a penchant for slapstick stupid comedy. And that's the last song, which is She Came Back, written by a young chap by the name of Mark Whitman. Uh-huh. Who I saw at an open mic in 2005 or 2009, maybe, somewhere around there. No, actually, I saw Mark in the late 90s just come up and sing the song straight through, and I fell off my chair, and I looked around, and nobody else was laughing. And I just grabbed that song, and to this day, I stay in touch with Mark, and he's a retired Boeing flight engineer now.
Oh, wow.
But he wrote that song that just is a killer for me.
Yeah,
and everything else on the album is mine.
Great. Well, you've heard my voice is one of the many songs we're playing from your CD on KC Cafe Radio, and I love that song. I also want to ask you about some of the songs on there.
Sure.
Probably my favorite song on the CD is Golden Apples. Can you tell me about that song?
Yeah, Golden Apples was written with a co-writer, Barry Kane, who I sang with in the New Christy Minstrels. And Barry Kane is probably one of the most vivid characters that I've ever known in my life. He was, even though he was born in Beverly Hills, you know, and to the day he died, poor Barry left us about 3 years ago, three years ago now. I'm sitting with my wife. How long ago was it, Judy? About 2 years ago. Barry passed away about 2 years ago. Barry was the gypsy of the New Christy Minstrels. He played flamenco guitar. He sang Spanish songs. He sang Russian gypsy folk songs. He sang Yiddish songs. He was a Theodore Bekel kind of folk singer, and with a very, very almost dark Russian gypsy mood when he played. It was mystical. Barry started writing this song, and I got together with him in the late 90s, and he said, I want to show you this thing I'm writing, and he showed me a little bit of the song he had written, and I said, do you mind if I take it and write some other stuff to it? And it was one of those beautiful collaborations where Barry and I wrote it together, and neither of us could say when it was over what it was about exactly, except for the fact that Golden Apples just is, I can't tell you what it is. It's a work of art that stands on its own feet. It speaks to different people of different things, but it makes sense. And that's what makes it balanced, and that's what makes it a song. I don't know what else to say about it. To me, it's the writer's muse, or it's the muse that lives deep inside of us that surfaces from time to time when we least expect it and surprises us. That's what it's about.
Well, that's what makes that song so good, is that it can mean, I mean, that's what makes good songs good, is they can mean something different to everybody.
I think this does. Well, that's a good way to put it, Kathy. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'll put that on the next liner note.
Okay, you can have that.
And I was just lucky enough when I was recording it to run into Jeunesse Johnson, who is one of the most talented and gifted virtuosos on the cello. Jeunesse is a well-known cellist in Switzerland. She came back to the United States, and she is just absolutely. As soon as she puts her hands on the cello, she just dives into the song with everything she's got.
Yeah.
And you can hear it. You can hear it in her playing on that song.
It's beautiful. You mentioned the New Christy Minstrels when you were talking about that song. Tell me about how you got involved with New Christy Minstrels. Were you in the early versions of that group?
Oh, yeah. This is, Randy Sparks, who is a prolific songwriter, and he was one of the people who was smart enough to understand that publishing is really where it is. Randy was part of the folk music group. He's a folk singer. He's got a really pleasant voice and a very prolific writer, a complete historian as far as California and history goes. And he just wrote a collection of folk songs and needed a large group to sing it. Mm-hmm. And so he assembled the New Christy Minstrels. He had some early people on, some people that were in the group even before I got there, before the first recording, of course, were some of the people who went on to become some pretty well-established folk singers. Some of the members of the association were part of the early New Christy Minstrels there. When we finally got around to recording the first album, Brandy convinced Columbia Records that we needed, that he could do this project. And so he assembled 12 of his songs, or 13 of his songs, and between himself and Jackie and Nick Woods, who were the three people in the Randy Sparks Three that they had been touring with, of all the folk singers in Los Angeles, they picked the ones that they thought would suit the group the best. Paul and I had split up, and I had started writing with Walter Shore, with whom I wrote You've Heard My Voice and You Know My Name. I wrote the music, he wrote the lyrics. And Brandy tapped me on the shoulder and said, do you guys want to... do you want to become a member of this group I'm putting together? It's only for recording. And it's going to be it's like a super group. We'll have, two people from this group, two people from that group. So he picked, of all the people in Los Angeles that were at that time currently recording, not performing around the coffee houses, Barry McGuire was performing with Barry Kane. I was performing. I was hanging around with Tommy and Dickie Smothers writing music. Everybody in the group was actually an established folk singer already doing something. He said, I want to put together not a choir, but a group of individual folk singers that could really make this thing work. And so we recorded our first album. I was on that first album. And then when Columbia heard the album, they went to Randy and they said, hey, listen, this is fine, but there's no point in releasing it unless we have a group.
Mm-hmm.
And so Randy came to us and says, look, the only way we could do it is get a group. He put together, he, business-wise, the guy really knew what he was doing. He got a couple of high-powered managers that somehow or other approached NBC and got a permanent spot on the Andy Williams variety show, which was on, I think, every Thursday night or Friday night on NBC as regulars. And so once he had that, he had some money to wave in front of us. And put together this group, and that's where the New Christy Minstrels really were born. We played the Troubadour to stand-up crowds, packed houses. And then before we knew it, within a very short time, we were touring with Andy Williams and Henry Mancini doing our music, our record on Columbia, since Columbia had all of this exposure for us on television. Columbia had released the record with a lot of fanfare. A record, by the way, is a round black thing with a little hole in the middle. This one
it plays at 33 and a third.
it plays at 33 and a third. Unless it's a hit, then it plays at 45.
45, yep.
Right. We won't talk about the old 78s, but that's what it was. It was, I was part of that original first burst onto the scene of the New Christy Minstrels, and that was in 1962 for the first album, and we were off and running, and that's when we kind of all, that's when we went off on our own trajectory, and I stayed with them until it started to fade. Once the New Christy Minstrels became real popular, remember what happened after that, when after John Kennedy was shot, the skies darkened a little bit, the clouds came in.
The world kind of changed.
And the world kind of changed, and music changed, and it wasn't my kind of change. Not that I disagreed with it, it's just that it wasn't in my in my skill set. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people moved right from that to the other, but it wasn't in my skill set. You know, the folk, the darker side of it, and the rock and roll side of it just was not part of what I did. So I just kind of let it go. I left the Minstrels, I think, in 66 or 67, and basically left the music business for several years and watched it all from a different vantage point.
So what year did you actually leave the music industry for a while?
I would say the early 70s I left. You know, I was in and out. I scored a film. Somebody asked me to score a film. I would do this or that. But there was no interest in folk music. Just one guy with a guitar standing up there and singing, unless you were Jackson Browne, you know, and writing your own material. And I had, you know, Walter and I had not, we're not writing stuff anymore. And I wasn't writing that kind of stuff. It just, somehow or other, I had played out what I knew. And I realized it, and I just left the music business completely.
And what were you doing between, in that time?
You know something? I found a really interesting home in Highline Automotive deals. I ended up becoming manager of one of the big Mercedes-Benz dealerships in Los Angeles, and stayed in and out of that business for, you know, a few years, more than a few. You know, for the next 15, 20 years. But I always dabbled in it. I always went back. I remember working at a big Mercedes-Benz dealership downtown L.A. on Figueroa Street, and I wrote a folk song called The Ballad of Figueroa Street, which will probably show up on my next CD. You know? I mean, once it's there, I remember that song, that line from the Kenny Rogers song, where he sees his old guitar stand waiting there in the corner, and it's always been like with me. It was like a secret friend and a secret lover. You know, every time you open the closet, the guitar is there, and every now and then you pick it up and you play, and you don't. And then I think we had a reunion of the New Christy Minstrels, of as many of the older group people as possible, in the early part of the, right around, what, 2005. And we toured. We did some nice tours around Middle America, performing arts centers with a whole bunch of the original members of the group. And that ended in 2009. We'd kind of played ourselves out, and the group still is out there with maybe one person, somebody who had been in the group previously.
Right.
That wasn't one of the originals. They're still out there, but I was done with it.
Yeah.
And so I came back to L.A., and I thought to myself, God, I really enjoy playing the guitar and doing this, and I was winding down my business career. And just thinking to myself, you know, I love it, but I need more colors in my crayon box. I don't know if you can understand what I'm saying. I don't know if there's any guitar players out there who've had enough coffee to listen to me ranting and rambling. if anybody out there that's doing that, I picked up the guitar. And if you haven't played in a while, what you do is you keep making the same turns. You know, I'd play a D chord, and then I'd go to the next line, and I'd play a G chord. I've only got three colors here in my crayon box. I got to get some more. So I started taking jazz guitar lessons, and it opened up so many doors for me. I'm not a jazz guitar player by any means. I mean, maybe someday, you know, because I keep doing it. But it started adding some new colors, new dimensions, and new directions that I could go. So if there's anybody out there who plays guitar, I would suggest, you know, taking a lesson or two in almost every style of guitar there is, and finding, because somewhere along the way, you'll find a new color crayon you've never seen before. And then when you go from the D to the G chord, and you think, geez, it would be nice if I had a chord in between those two, you'll be able to find something that you never knew existed before, and it'll take you someplace that you've never been. And that was almost my salvation. And that's when I wrote my first song that I'd written in a long time, which is on the CD, which is called The Highway.
Okay, wonderful. As a guitarist player myself, I find that, like, if I learn other people's songs, it kind of opens me up as
absolutely.
A songwriter as well.
Absolutely.
Because you're learning new chords, or you're learning new ways to move from one chord to another. Or
that's right. Didn't we all start by learning somebody else's songs?
I don't know anybody. Usually, I mean, yeah.
Nobody picks up a guitar and says, I'm going to write a song.
Yeah.
You know, you pick it up and you learn the songs of the people that you admire and the people you love and the music that's touched you.
Right.
And then after you've chewed it up a little bit and you spit it out, it's yours. That's the way it happens. That's evolution. That's the way people mesh, and that's friendship. That's evolution, and it's love. It's everything.
Right.
You know, you emulate what you love, and it comes out unique.
Right. I want to go back a little bit on your history here. You went from the Greenwich Village and being born in Brooklyn, and then you've made it out to California. How did you get from the East Coast to the West Coast?
Winter.
You were tired of the winters on the East Coast?
No, what happened? It was real simple. It was real simple. Paul and I did a television show. It was one of the talent scout shows on television. I think it was hosted by, I can't even remember. Vic Damone hosted it. It was Celebrity Talent Scouts. And we did it, and somebody in Boulder, Colorado, a guy by the name of Mike Bassesi, he owned a place called Mike's Pub, who was a folk club, because remember, right around then, folk music was starting to make money, and so the guy had a stage and microphone and a nice little Italian restaurant, and he invited us out to play. So we went out there and played, and we were just a monster hit out there. People loved us. First of all, Paul's comedy had people peeing in their pants and falling in the aisles. I'm telling you, you can't go to a supermarket with Paul shopping without somehow or other dropping your cookies there because of some silly move or a face he makes. The guy was wonderful. Anyway, we were big hits in Boulder, so we would come back to New York. And we'd get another call saying, oh, they want you back. So we'd go back to Boulder. That's where we made friends with David Crosby. He used to meet us at the airport. Remember, he was a little high school kid.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, all of these people would come visit us in Boulder while we were doing our shows. The Smothers Brothers would come into the club and introduce themselves. And they were a comedy team. Jerry and Myrna Music used to come. We met so many people in Boulder because it was the whole West Coast crowd. It was Denver and the West Coast crowd. And we had heard about rumblings in California, and I had a good friend of mine who lived in California who would communicate with me and tell me, you know, you guys got to come out here, come out to the Troubadour. And so one day, Paul and I are sitting in New York, and Columbia Records had, and what had happened was, the Brothers Four had hit the world with Greenfields. It was their big hit on Columbia Records.
Mm-hmm.
And Columbia was kind of favoring them because Art and Paul were so eclectic. There were little markets that loved us, but we just weren't making it on the national scene. Nobody knew what to do with us. Albert Grossman even auditioned us for the Newport Folk Festival and looked at us, and basically the look on his face was the same look as the guy's face in Llewellyn Davis. He said, yeah, you guys are great. He said, I've never seen anything like you, but I don't see any money here. You know, he was afraid to put us up in front of a folk crowd.
Yeah.
You know, because the folk crowd for the Newport Folk Festival, this was traditional folk music.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it was a different genre, you know. We were doing what were these guys doing? This is like half Broadway, half jazz, half folk. The Swingle, we sounded like the Swingle singers. We were doing intricate harmonies and intricate moves and counterpoint. And so, I mean, he said, I'd rather just leave these guys alone. They're not in my, you know, he didn't understand what we were doing.
Yeah.
But somehow or other, the people in California kind of liked it. So somebody said, you ought to go to California. I remember one day, Paul and I sitting in Greenwich Village, and we said, listen, we've got an audience in Boulder. Columbia Records is kind of getting a little lukewarm on us. I don't expect them to be really pushing for us to even do a third album. We did two. Why don't we go to California? So we took all of our winter clothes, drove down Third Avenue in our old jalopy, and handed our coats to the bums on the Bowery, as we were driving up town and then froze our way through the Midwest until we got to California.
Wow. And so that's how you, were you doing television stuff in California then?
No TV in California. What we did in California is another story. I don't want this all to sound self-serving. It's like, I feel like the Forrest Gump of folk music. I was there when when a lot of big things happened, except I was in the kitchen getting myself a soda while it was the big things were happening in the living room. But somebody told me, my friend in California was a big fan of jazz and a good friend of some of the owners of the jazz clubs. And she said, you know, you really ought to talk about the Troubadour because they tried folk music once, but he doesn't know what he's doing. His name is Doug Weston. So we met Doug Weston on a street corner, and we asked him, we said, you know, we're kind of like big stars in the Midwest and we have two albums in Columbia. He said, I don't even know if I'm going to keep the Troubadour open. He said, because it's not working. You know, it's not happening. He said, we're thinking about it, making it a jazz club. I said, well, Doug, jazz is kind of good, but it's kind of, you know, losing favor, and folk music is coming back. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I can't pay you. I said, well, you know, we'll sing and see if anybody comes, then you pay us. He said, well, you know, he said, where are you staying? I said, we're staying with friends. He said, well, you could stay at the Troubadour if you want. We got a little kitchen there. You can eat, you know, if you want to try it out, you know, I'll be willing to do that for you. And I said, okay. So we went in there in June of 61. And by the time we left, we were there for 14 straight weeks. At the Troubadour. That was the summer that folk music exploded. And it's not because of Art and Paul. It's that we were there, we were the main act, and we would sing at the Ice House, we would sing at the Troubadour, we were singing Puff the Magic Dragon. It was all part of that thing. And then that's when the whole folk music thing started to bubble and gain momentum, and we were right at the center of it. We were playing at the Troubadour as regulars, and then we introduced Hootenanny Night at the Troubadour, and I ran the Hootenannies for quite a while, and that's where I got to meet a lot of other people. Right around then, right after our first season of the Troubadour, Paul decided he wanted to be a dramatic actor and didn't want to sing folk songs anymore. And I don't blame him, because we weren't, you know, we were there. A lot of people said if we had just hung in there another 6 months, we would have been major stars. But, you know, so what? I mean...
So, is the Troubadour where you met the Smothers Brothers?
No, I met the Smothers Brothers in Boulder,
Boulder, really?
Colorado, because that was our big step. But whenever we'd get a little frustrated with Los Angeles, we'd always just jump in the car and go back to Boulder, and there was always an audience there for us.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the Smothers Brothers they did a lot of work in Denver, and that's where we met. We met in Boulder. When Paul and I broke up, I got a letter from Tommy Smothers saying how terrible he felt, and I toured with the Smothers Brothers. After Paul and I broke up, before the New Christy Minstrels, Tommy and Dickie and I, that was it. I was there. I played banjo. I sat on a stool behind them and played banjo. And they sang three or four of my songs, because at that time I was writing with Walter Shore. And they were singing the songs that Walter and I had written. In fact, when they did their Smothers Brothers show, I think one of our songs, Tommy told me, was the most played song that they've ever done on their show, a thing called Lark Day, which had been on the New Christy Minstrel album also.
So what kind of songs were you writing back then?
You've heard my voice, you know my name. I was writing stuff like what the Smothers Brothers, If It Fits Your Fancy, I'll sing, you know, kind of nice bouncy folk songs.
Uh-huh.
I wrote one song with Rod McEwen. That ended up doing quite well. As a matter of fact, it was the number one song in Europe for about eight weeks straight. Number one, France, Belgium, Luxembourg, called So Long, Stay Well. It was recorded by Bud and Travis.
Mm.
Another name. You know the name Bud and Travis?
I've heard it, yeah. Uh-huh.
If you ever want to hear two guys who are a consummate duet in singing and playing, these two guys should have again, should have, but these are hidden treasures for a lot of people. Button Travis, nobody's ever done what Button Travis have done. They were so good and talented. They did a lot of Spanish music because they're both from the Southwest. Mm-hmm. But they also did some brilliant stuff. So Long Stay Well did very well for me and Rod.
Mm-hmm.
Rod Bukulin. Barry McGuire recorded it. Barry and I were really close friends in the during the New Christy Minstrel days. In fact, Barry's going to be doing, he's coming out of retirement to do a show, I think, this Thursday night down at here in Los Angeles.
That's wonderful. I wish he would get back out there and play again. That would be wonderful.
Yeah. Well, he's retired, but I don't believe him. Barry, when it comes to retiring, any musician tells you he's retiring, he's lying.
Yeah, when you're a songwriter or you're a musician, you never really retire. You're still playing.
You can't. It's part of your supply. Your support system.
Yeah, it's your lifeblood. Yeah.
I mean, ask my wife. How many times do I just get up from a television show, even in the middle of an exciting part, and run and grab the guitar? Because right there in the back of my head, I'm looking for this. Well, I've been looking for this one chord for a month, you know. And if I think I found it, I don't care what's going on. I'll get out of a speeding car to get to find that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, what did you decide to do from the Village to the Canyon now at this point in your life?
You know, from the Village to the Canyon was not my concept, although it just felt so natural when it was presented to me that it just made sense to do. I have a close friend who's actually a retired account executive who's just an incredibly knowledgeable music person. He sent me an email once and he said, this is really what the album should be, because it's, you know, he heard the songs and he said, that's what this is. This is your history from Greenwich mm-hmm. Village to Laurel Canyon. Because Laurel Canyon plays very importantly in my life, because everybody thinks of Laurel Canyon. That's how this my CD ended up at the Grammy Museum. They did an exhibit on Laurel Canyon, and what they did was they started with the Laurel Canyon of the mid '60s, from the book by Harvey Kubernick, on Laurel Canyon, when Joni Mitchell was there, and Stephen Stills, Crosby, Stills and Nash, and all of those people were, and Neil Young, all those people lived in the canyon, Frank Zappa.
Were the Mamas and Papas there at that time,
and
too?
The Mamas and Papas, yeah, but see, that all started in 1965. I moved up to the canyon in 1961, before there were too many folk singers. I don't know if any other folk singers that were up there. It was just, you know, some artists and some actors, and I just found myself a little hole in the wall. I had my dog Dink with me. Dink just talked about it in my CD. I wrote a song about her.
Yeah.
Well, she was with me everywhere. She caused me some terrible breakups with girls because I had this one girl.
The dog knows.
And in fact, the fence I built for Dink in Laurel Canyon is still there. I went back and visited it with Dickie Davis about a month ago. 6 months ago. But they did the, and I heard about this exhibit, and I said, wait a minute, you're missing all of 1961 through to 1965. And so I got to meet with them and show them some stuff, and they said, well, we've got to have that. So they invited me to participate in the opening and to speak on stage and talk about the early days. My first experience with Laurel Canyon was my own little place, and then I decided I'd need a bigger place, and I found one, but I couldn't afford it myself. It was a house. And so, of course, I was running the Troubadours, and this young kid came in from, had just finished touring with another folk music group, and he was from Chicago, a kid by the name of Jim McGuinn, who later changed his name to Roger from the Birds.
Right.
And I went to McGuinn, and I said, McGuinn, you and I kind of are from the same school of music. We both love Bob Gibson. We both love Pete Seeger. We both play like that. You're better than me, but, you know, maybe I can learn something. you want to share a house with me? He said, absolutely. And so we rented a house together. McGuinn
wow.
and I roomed together up in Laurel Canyon in 1961. And so the whole musical history of coming from Greenwich Village And moving out to California ultimately and ending up in Laurel Canyon is kind of the theme that, that my friend Tom Pickles, who's the guy I'm talking about, who is kind of like a marketing guy, He's the guy who invented Chicken McNuggets. He was once one of the head people at McDonald's, but with an incredible knowledge of folk music.
Wow.
Tom suggested the title, and I said, well, heck, if you're in a marketing business and you've suggested that title, then show me what the cover's supposed to look like. He said, you got it, and that was it. Tom took care of all of that for me.
Yeah, that's great.
And if he's listening, thank you, Tom. Thank you, Tom. Now, there are some people that know how to put pictures together from what's available and what's appropriate. And that's a particular genius that not everybody has. Tom does have it.
Right. Yeah. And a cover of a CD can draw a person into wanting to hear it. So, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a picture of the Café Wah there. And there's a picture of, you know, of, I don't know, the word canyon.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Grammy exhibit. You can get your CD from the Village to the Canyon signed by you through your website right now. So I want to make sure everybody knows that.
Right. Oh, no, yeah, let me tell you what I told you this, earlier. Yeah, when I met all the people at the Grammy Museum, they have a gift shop and they had displays and they asked me what could I contribute that would be, you know, appropriate. And I said, well, I have my old Goya G3 guitar back in the early 60s, a G30. I can't remember the model number now. Pardon me. I need about my fourth cup of coffee to do that one. It's a Goya nylon string guitar. I tell you something, it's easy. If you lived in Greenwich Village back in those days or in Laurel Canyon, you were never more than 100 yards from a Goya G3. Somebody had one.
That was the instrument of choice, huh?
It was the folk guitar. It was not high priced. It was a good price. Mine was built in 1958. And I still have it. And I said, well, I have a G3. They said, oh, great, we'd love it. So it was up in the Laurel Canyon exhibit. And I said, and I have this CD. They said, well, we'd love to sell this CD in our gift shop. And I was just very flattered. And they said, but we want you to sign every copy. So I had to open up every copy, sign every label, and then send it back to the company to have it rewrapped. They're all unplayed CDs. I still have a nice supply of them left from the gift shop. Of course, I gave them everything I had. and so I have that supply now, and until those are all sold out, that's what I'm off. That's what I'm selling on my website. That's
while
what I've
supplies
got.
Last, so act
well,
now.
While supplies last. Well, that's what's on my business card. Art Podell, while supplies last.
His music's also available on iTunes and CD Baby, but you'll want to go to the website and get one of the signed CDs that was actually at the Grammy exhibit. So that's a really cool thing to have.
Yeah, it was at the Grammy Museum exhibit.
Wonderful. Well, I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I could talk to you for another hour, I think, about music and the folk scene and everything that happened back then.
Kathy, anytime. I don't care if it's on the air or not. I'm flattered and so pleased that this is an opportunity to tell some of these stories. But I don't mind you calling me at all.
Okay. Well, maybe sometime we'll do another edition of Chatting with Art.
Okay. I really appreciate it. And this CD was a labor of love, and we're working on some new stuff, some interesting stuff. Digging deeper into history for some reason or other.
When do you think you'll have a new CD coming out?
I think I'm at least a year away. I'm just working on it. And again, I went back and I'm taking more lessons. And I'm thinking about learning some other things. The whole idea of not being happy with everything you do on the guitar and pushing into new directions. I would recommend that to anybody. You know, take a jazz lesson, take a flamenco lesson, take a classical lesson. Just stretch somewhere. You may not want to end up there, but it's going to color what you do and give you more tools in your toolbox. And that way you'll find things to talk about in ways that you've never thought of. And that's what makes creativity fun for the creator. As far as will it be fun to the listener, that's for the rest of the world to decide.
Right, but at least it'll be fun for you, and that way you'll keep going and keep wanting to create. Because I think people get stagnant is when they stop creating, and that's when it stops being art, and it starts being business. So.
Yeah, well, you know, we can talk about the differences between the two and the places where they're married, but that's another conversation. I don't know if it would do us any good.
Yeah. You can find Art's music at www.artpodell. It's P-O-D-E-L-L. And we're looking forward to hearing a new CD coming out hopefully next year. And for the meantime, go ahead and check out Art's latest CD, From the Village to the Canyon. It's a wonderful, wonderful CD, and it's a musical journey, really, from a wonderful folk singer, songwriter, and journeyman in the music industry.
Do you have time? I don't know if you have time to talk about Tony's poem on there. That's a real Laurel Canyon story. I don't know how I missed that one, but if we're finished with our conversation, that'll be for another time. But that's an actual historical event that happened at Laurel Canyon.
Well, go ahead and tell us about that real quick. Or not real quick, but just go ahead and tell us about it. We got time.
In a nutshell, we used to, as folk singers, we had our friends, and one of my friends was Toni Stern, who was a lovely little gal. She was a high school girl who lived in Laurel Canyon. Mm-hmm. And we all used to gather at Toni's house, and we'd sing our little folk songs, sit around, and Toni would read her poetry. Like many high school girls, she always wrote poems. She had them in a little big folder, a large folder in her bedroom, and I remember listening to her poems. One day I'm driving. This is after I had left the minstrels. I hadn't seen Toni in years and was totally disconnected from the music business. I was driving to work one day, and I heard this song on the radio, and I said, "My God, that's Toni's poem!" It sounds like one of Toni's poems that I may have heard, or not. So I tried to find Toni, and I found her, and I said, "Toni, I'm listening to the radio. I'm listening to the song." She says, "Oh yeah." She said, "That's my song. I wrote the words." I said, "Yeah, I recognize them. They're kind of like your poems, and maybe even that poem." She says, "Yeah." She said, "Yeah, this gal broke up with her husband and moved in next door to me." She and I used to have coffee every day, and we became friends. And then her producer said, "I'd like you to make an album." And so she made an album of love songs, but she didn't have any real personal love songs. And I don't know, I showed her my poetry, and that, you know, she liked this one. And so she sang it. It was Carole King, and the song was "It's Too Late, Baby." It's one of Thomas' poems that I heard in Laura. Pretty sure I heard that poem on Laurel Canyon in 1961, 62. Wow. And Toni has become, he's written two songs with Carole, written some songs for the Monkees, and we're still friends to this day. But that actually, I remember hearing those words in Laurel Canyon in 1961.
Wow, that's amazing.
And that's the story. The story of that is on the CD. It's written into music.
Yeah, which song is that one?
It's called Toni's Poem.
Okay.
I was just going off to become a famous folk singer with the New Christy Minstrels. And Toni was one of our friends. She used to come to the Troubadour to hear. Barry and I both, were good friends with Barry McGuire, and I were good friends with Toni. And it was a whole group of us. We'd get together up at Toni's house. She had a little house up in Laurel Canyon. Anyway, I just thought I'd inject that one because that one's got some real history. That song's got some real history to it. If you listen to it carefully, you'll pick out all the players.
Yeah, that's neat. Yeah, so that's another reason to buy the album. You're going to hear a real history of arts music and of music scene in America in the 60s. So, thanks again, Art.
And thank you guys for all of the support and help, and you guys have been wonderful.